We're in a little bit of a different location for this ASA meeting, but I think we'll do okay. You know, for about 15 or 20 years, lots of us actually taught in this room here. And looking out, it doesn't look so bad. I mean, you know, this is a pretty nice space, even though it's not quite up to the standards of our science building, our new science building. But we got bumped from that building tonight, so I'm glad you all found us on this cold evening, and looks like we got a pretty good crowd. Welcome, everybody. Let me first introduce myself. I'm Rod Scott. I'm a biology professor here at the college, and I'm also part of the steering committee for the local ASA chapter. And so it's my duty and privilege to welcome you here and to get us all started. And let me just begin that with a word of prayer. So if you'd join with me. God, we thank you that places like this exist. We thank you that organizations like the ASA exist that encourage us as people with an interest in science to look at the way we do our science from the perspective of a Christian worldview. God, we thank you for folks like Tim who are going to speak tonight and just help us to get a little bit clearer vision for that marriage between our Christian worldview and our work as scientists. God, we just pray that everything we do and say here tonight would be in a vein that would bring glory to you. And we ask that you would help us to do that in every aspect of our work and our lives as people that are dedicated to your service and also people who are interested in pursuing this fascinating area of scientific investigation. God, we thank you for these things, and we ask that you would be involved in our time tonight. And we ask in Christ's name. Amen. So I know that a lot of you have joined us here before for these local meetings of the American Scientific Affiliation. If you haven't been here with us before, I've got some information about the ASA on the screen behind me. We are essentially a group of folks that are interested in pursuing our vocation as scientists, or at least our interest in the areas of science, with a mindset of also embracing the Christian worldview. It's a very broad tent. If you are a person who is committed to the Lordship of Jesus Christ, but also have an interest in this area of the scientific disciplines, then you certainly are welcome with us. You're welcome even if you don't fit into those categories, but you're welcome to join the American Scientific Affiliation if you fit into those two categories. We take the perspective that we have a certain set of essentials that we all hold to, but we also agree to disagree on the non-essentials. We feel like God has certainly revealed himself in the scripture, in his special revelation, but we also, as scientists and people interested in the areas of science, feel like God has spoken to us specifically and reliably through his creation, his general revelation. So we invite you to investigate the ASA, join that organization if you'd like to. If you aren't quite there yet, though, we certainly encourage your attendance here at these meetings on a regular basis. So let me just say a little bit more about that. Obviously, if you want to investigate the ASA, you can look at the website there. We've got asa3.org. ASA 1 and 2 were apparently already taken. Tonight, we've got Dr. Tim Larson speaking to us on this question of what is this all about, this idea of the war between science and faith. And Robert Bishop is going to introduce Tim in just a couple of minutes. But I also wanted to just mention to you that we've got a couple of other events. We are not specifically hosting the Science Symposium, but every year Wheaton College does host a symposium that is the work of one particular department in our division. This year it's the physics department, and they are going to be having a couple of sessions on this idea of nuclear energy, realizing the promise. Wednesday night, there's a film Pandora's Promise, and then after that film, there's a panel session. It's going to debrief on that film. And then Thursday night, various speakers who are all experts in the area of nuclear energy. So if that's something that piques your interest, that's going to be coming up in the end of March. Then we at the ASA will have another meeting on April 10th. Dr. Jerry Rao is going to be speaking to us about his recently published book, published via the Varsity Press, on mapping the origins debate, six models of the beginning of everything. So if just this little bit has piqued your interest, I would certainly encourage you, if you're not already on our mailing list, to please sign up. You've got my email address right here. Just zip me an email, and I will be sure to get you on our mailing list. And we promise not to spam you. We'll just give you the important information about things going on with the ASA. Okay, before we get started, let me also just do this one rather ignoble task, which is to sort of highlight our need for a little bit of help with our finances. We don't need an awful lot, but we do need a little bit to keep the honoraria flowing and to record these sessions, get them posted on our ASA website. So if you can, we would just ask for a little donation, maybe $5 or so. If there are some students in our midst or people of equally modest means, you know, you don't have to contribute, but if you feel like you can, you'd ask for a contribution of maybe $5 or so. The intricacies in this room are not quite so difficult as they are in the Meyer Science Building. The only thing is you have to try to remember once it gets up to the top there, so pass it across the row, back and forth across the bottom section, and then when you get to the last row, pass it up to the next tier, so that these folks up there don't miss out on the opportunity to contribute. Okay? If you picked up a name tag, if you could leave that with us after the presentation, that would be excellent. All right, I've already mentioned that tonight Dr. Tim Larson is going to speak to us on this idea of the warfare between science and faith, and Robert Bishop is from the physics department here at the college.
Bring the lights up. That'd be great. Okay, so I get my notes out here. So it's quite a pleasure and an honor for me to introduce my colleague, Professor Timothy Larson. If we were in Germany, I always have to say Professor Dr. Mr. Timothy Larson, but we're in America, so we're just going to stick with that. So some of you know who Tim Larson is, and some of you don't know. So let me just give you a little bit of information. Even those of you who know something about him, maybe there'll be something new here. So he is the Carolyn and Fred McManus Professor of Christian Thought at Wheaton College. He did his BA in History with Honors here at Wheaton. He did a master's, an MA, in theology here at Wheaton. And then he left Wheaton to do his PhD at the University of Stirling in Scotland in history. So there's a theme developing there, history and theology, which will appear, I believe, in his talk tonight. He's been on the faculty of Wheaton College since 2002 in the Bible and Theology department. Okay, so he's also, he has been a visiting fellow at many, many places. I'll just mention two. He was at All Souls College in Oxford, and also a visiting fellow at Trinity College in Cambridge. If you've ever looked at his website, you know that he is a prolific author. Indeed, I could read all of his publications, and there would be about 10 minutes for questions left at the time we got finished, and that won't really fit, I think, with Dr. Larson's talk. So let me just highlight three things out of his publication list that I think are of interest to perhaps anyone in the room who is fascinated with this topic that Dr. Larson will be addressing this evening. First is a book that's called The Crisis of Doubt, Honest Faith in 19th Century England. I should say 19th century is sort of, it's his century. He loves the Victorians and other crazy things. the 19th century, and there will be a lot of that on display tonight. That's an Oxford University publication. It's a book that actually talks about the 19th century in a way that we're not used to talking about it. Typically, we think of the 19th century as a crisis of faith, where faith is being lost as people are becoming agnostic or atheist or going in various kinds of directions. And in this book, Dr. Larson talks about several key figures in the 19th century who made a journey that looks like that. They seem to leave faith, kind of like prodigal sons, if you will, but then end up coming back to faith in such a way that they become an even stronger proponent in terms of their own writing and speaking on behalf of Christianity. Right, so that's a book that I think you'll find very interesting. Those stories are quite engaging, and they will give you some ideas about what the lay of the land, why the lay of the land looks the way it does today, in terms of perhaps the so-called new atheists who are just already dreaded in the 19th century. Dr. Larson has some publications that indicate that too, I think. His most recent book is one that he's just finished. It's a project on anthropology. It's called The Slain God, Anthropologists and the Christian Faith. That will be forthcoming in September, is the plan, from University of Cambridge Press. And it examines the point at which faith, on the one hand, and doubt collide with anthropology and the evidence. So I think this will be a fascinating read, and I'm looking forward to it. Those of you who are on the mailing list noted that we did mention a publication in the ASA Journal, Perspectives on Science and Christian Faith, and it's called The War is Over, If You Want It, Beyond the Conflict Between Faith and Science. It sounds strangely like the title he has for tonight. His talk's very much based on that article. It was published in September of 2008. But I understand that out of the recent work that he's been doing on the history of anthropology and this intersection with faith and doubt, that Tim has some new things to add to this story that he will share with us tonight. So, Tim, please come forward and give your wisdom.
Good evening.
Good evening.
If you have read the article from 2008 Perspectives, you might want to have your iPhone out and multitask for this talk, because this is definitely a version of that. But there's about 4 or 5 points of the talk where I've added in things that I really thought of afterwards, or have learned afterwards, or wish I would have said. So you can look up appropriately when those happen. History is not as technical a field as natural sciences, but nevertheless, in my view, it deserves precision enough that I'm going to mainly read to you so that I get my claims measured and right and my facts straight. But I will look up occasionally to show you my social skills, so all is well. My goal in this talk is to help you see the false claims and assumptions that undergird the common notion of a war between faith and science. The warfare model became established in the Victorian age. In its telling of things, the 19th century is when the human race learned enough to realize that faith is not credible. In any event, if some daring and perceptive souls had discovered this earlier, it was the century in which this realization became widespread. Those people who were intelligent and brave, and keeping up with their reading, therefore, inevitably lost their faith. As my work in the book Crisis of Doubt on the Conversion of Secularist Leaders to Christianity reveals, as well as work on Victorian Christian intellectuals, this is simply a false picture of the relationship between faith and learning in the 19th century. The intellectual claims of orthodoxy were actually quite compelling to many of the bravest, smartest, best-read people, even ones who had a deep bias against Christianity and a vested interest in opposing it. The so-called war between faith and learning, specifically between orthodox Christian theology and science, was manufactured during the second half of the 19th century. It is a construct that was created for political purposes. The main architects of the notion of a war between theology and science were anti-religious scientists and advocates of secular education. An enormously influential book in this regard was John William Draper's History of the Conflict Between Religion and Science, 1874. Draper, who was a professor of chemistry at New York University, is an example of a scientist fueling the notion that the relationship between faith and learning should be viewed as a conflict. His book was so successful that it went through 50 editions in the half century after its publication. A famous successor in the same vein was Andrew Dixon White's A History of the Warfare of Science with Theology in Christendom, 1896. White was the founding president of Cornell University, an upstart institution that used its secular stance as a way of setting it apart in the market from the old Ivy League schools that, for example, still had mandatory chapel attendance. Draper and White were not simply describing an ongoing war between theology and science, but rather they were endeavoring to induce people into imagining that there was one. In order to do this, they repeatedly made false claims that the church had opposed various scientific breakthroughs and developments. For example, Draper and White encoded into popular thinking the erroneous notion that Christian orthodoxy had insisted for centuries that the earth was flat. A standard version of this urban legend includes a tale claiming that Columbus's expedition was opposed by church leaders, including on the grounds that it was based on the heretical notion that the earth was round. It has also been so effectively disseminated that even Christians generally assume that it is true. I found this book in the Wheaton College Library just maybe the year before I wrote this talk, and it was, you know, a good-hearted Christian pastor, and he wrote this book about the five apologies for sinful behavior that the church needed to give. Each chapter was on a different apology. So it was kind of Christianity being transparent, owning up to its feelings and past, which we need to do. I'm a historian. But one of these five chapters, the five most important things Christianity is to apologize for, was entitled, "We're Sorry for Saying the Earth is Flat." Well, I can save him that one because we never said that, okay? Christianity never, ever claimed the earth was flat. In fact, Christian theologians have always declared the earth is round, from the early church through the medieval to the Reformation and beyond. Even the Venerable Bede, a monk living in the 8th century, after the fall of the Roman Empire and before the reign of Charlemagne, a period which the old history books used to call the Dark Ages, because it was seen as a low point in the state of human learning, asserted this unequivocally. And I remember reading up on Bede to give a church history lecture and reading his works, and suddenly reading him to say that the earth should be thought of as a ball. And I thought, I didn't know he knew that. Again, why didn't I know that? Because there's this propaganda machine that said Christians always said the earth was flat. He never said it. You can find the same view in the writings of Thomas Aquinas and the high medieval period, or pretty much anywhere you look.
Your mic has gone off. I'm sorry.
You're right.
Can you just try to project?
It's got a red light. It shows it's not happening. Okay. I'll give up on that.
Sorry about that.
No, yeah.
I just put new batteries in there.
I will keep an eye on the red eye. See if anything happens. Okay. Okay, moreover, all the church leaders who discussed Columbus's possible expedition with him assumed that the earth was round. Their objection was that the earth was much bigger than he was assuming, and therefore Columbus's calculations regarding how long it would take to reach India were inaccurate. These medieval clerics were, of course, right about this. Their scientific theories were more accurate than those of Columbus. The eminent evolutionary biologist and non-theist Stephen Jay Gould, in a full and candid exposure of this false claim that the church once taught a flat earth, has carefully explained how, quote, the 19th century invention of the flat earth occurred to support another dubious and harmful separation, the supposed warfare between science and religion, unquote. Another example is in the field of anesthetics. Draper and White also popularized the urban legend that the church opposed the use of anesthetics for women during childbirth on the grounds that it was a violation of the statement in Genesis that childbirth would be painful. Thank you for that. In 2006, Deborah Bloom, a Pulitzer Prize winning science writer and a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, wrote in the New York Times, which I would assume would be a heavily fact-checked publication, "When 19th century doctors began using chloroform to alleviate the pain of childbirth, the Scottish Calvinist Church declared it a satanic invention intended to frustrate the Lord's design."
this is completely, simply wrong. First of all, there is no such thing as a Scottish Calvinist church, and any version of that that you would break down, there's no church who ever claimed this. Moreover, there was no vocal group of ministers who opposed it. Indeed, there was not a single sermon, preacher, article in a Christian periodical or any other direct evidence that any Christian ever took this view. My friend Alan Jacobs took some of my writing on this and blogged about it and generated a lot of traffic. And the one person who could come up with any kind of evidence, it was hearsay evidence. It was somebody who wrote, you know, a letter saying, I overheard these two Christians talking and they said this, you know. So no minister, no religious newspaper anywhere ever said this. In fact, the inventor of chloroform received fan mail from ministers from the majority, from the major denominations, thanking him for helping to alleviate the suffering of women in labor. And the opposition to anesthetics during childbirth was by medical professionals rather than ministers, and for scientific rather than religious reasons. Just last year, Susan Jacoby published a book entitled The Great Agnostic, Robert Ingersoll and American Free Thought with Yale University Press. Once again, a press that I would think would be good at fact-checking. She has been convinced by the warfare model of faith and science, and in order to illustrate it, leads with the most damning case that she knows, namely that Christians oppose anesthetics for women in labor. Again, this is completely an urban legend, originally manufactured for polemical reasons, and still perpetuated to this day by an ill-informed atheist subculture that nevertheless gets published by Yale University Press and the New York Times. In the warfare of faith and science, if the warfare of faith and science myth is the equivalent of thinking that President Obama is anti-American, then the anesthetics clincher to prove it makes one a birther in another sense. A major figure in the construction of the notion of a war between theology and science was T.H. Huxley, the English biologist who was a principal champion of Darwinism and who coined the word agnosticism to describe his own viewpoint regarding religion. James Moore has observed that warfare was Huxley's favorite metaphor for the relationship between science and religion. Huxley even described himself as a gladiator general in this alleged fight. T.H. Huxley saved his most savage attack for a Roman Catholic biologist, St. George Jackson Mervet. Mervet's infuriating crime was not to reject scientific claims, but rather to accept them. He claimed that Darwinism was perfectly compatible with historic Christian teaching. Huxley was so angry with this Catholic thinker because Huxley was trying to generate the perception of a war between faith and learning. Huxley insisted that Mervet had to choose whether he wanted to be a true son of the church or a loyal soldier of science. Again, notice the military metaphor. In short, Huxley was not witnessing a fight between faith and science, but rather trying to provoke one. So, one may well ask, why? Why did Huxley want a fight? Why did Draper and White manufacture evidence in order to lead people to imagine that there was one? Why was the notion of a war between faith and science constructed in the second half of the 19th century? Frank M. Turner, who was a professor at Yale, argued persuasively that the notion of a conflict between theology and science was generated as part of a campaign of professionalization by would-be scientists. In the mid-19th century, there was no such profession. Charles Babbage, the brilliant mathematician who first conceived the programmable computer, observed in 1851, science in England is not a profession. Its cultivators are scarcely recognized even as a class. Our language itself contains no single term by which their occupation can be expressed. In other words, this was before there were scientists. Instead, there were only men of science, a term like its counterpart, men of letters, that referred more to the leisure pursuits of gentlemen than to what someone did for a living. Until several decades into the 19th century, there were only two universities in England, Oxford and Cambridge. Both saw classics, that is, the literature and philosophy of ancient Greece and Rome, as the rightful core of university curriculum, and therefore had few faculty positions in the natural sciences. Moreover, in order to hold a position at these universities, one would have to be ordained in the Church of England, and thus also a clergyman. The same would have been true of schools for children, for many of the schools for children and youth. There were no state schools until 1870, and therefore most schools, especially the elite ones, such as Eton, Harrow, Rugby, had explicitly Anglican identities. Indeed, being a priest in the Church of England was widely seen as the most sensible way to make a living for someone who had scholarly interests he wished to pursue. The Christian ministry was a learned profession that allowed one considerable time to invest in intellectual pursuits of one's own choosing. For example, Connop Thirlwall, who would eventually rise in the Church of England to be a bishop. Nevertheless, his sympathetic biographer admitted that Thirlwall's ordination was determined, quote, in cold-blooded fashion, simply by force of circumstances in order to obtain a decent leisure for his literary pursuits. Therefore, most scientific work in England was being done by clergymen. Moreover, much of it was remarkably good work. Not only were many of the nation's greatest men of science also clergymen, but also numerous more obscure clergymen up and down the country were carefully, patiently, and accurately cataloging the natural world and discovering its secrets. One could see how this would be very annoying to Huxley, who wanted to be a man of science himself, but, not least because of his agnostic views, was unable to make a living either as an Oxbridge professor or as a clergyman. In fact, as celebrated as Huxley was, his career was not as a university professor or some such position that we would assume to be fitting one for a scientist of his reputation today. Rather, he was fortunate to make a living by lecturing at the Government School of Mines, and even this opportunity would not have been available earlier in the century. Huxley and others who aspired to turn scientific pursuits into a profession therefore needed a war between science and religion. The purpose of the war was to discredit clergymen as suitable figures to undertake scientific work in order that the new breed of professionals would have an opportunity to fill in the gap for such work created by eliminating the current man of science. It was therefore tendentiously asserted that the religious convictions of clergymen disqualified them from pursuing their scientific inquiries objectively. More to the point, however, was that clergymen were undertaking their work for the sheer love of science, and thus hindering the expectation that it would be done for money by full-time scientists. Clergymen were branded amateurs in order to facilitate the creation of a new category of professionals, and then they were branded as biased or anti-science so as to exclude them from competitors in this new profession. In addition to Draper and White, another book that illustrates this point is Francis Galton's English Men of Science, Their Nature and Nurture, 1874. Galton, like Huxley, also wanted there to be a war. His research for the book included sending out questionnaires to scientists. To his disappointment, the overwhelming majority reported that religious beliefs were in no way a hindrance to scientific work. In an ironically unscientific way, he decided to ignore these results and simply to assert in his book that religious convictions were uncongenial to the pursuit of science, despite the fact that his own data did not support this conclusion. If I can make a short sort of detour into the social sciences, while less scholarly work has been done on this, I think a similar professional dimension is a significant factor in the perception of a war between faith and anthropology. I've spent the last several years studying this, and the book is hopefully coming out in September. In a professionalization reading of the situation, missionaries needed to be labeled biased amateurs in order to make room for a new category of professionals, the anthropologists. Anthropologists have been so forceful in their attacks on missionaries precisely because missionaries are so good at doing excellent anthropological work. Indeed, anthropologists have a hard time competing with them. The heart of good anthropological research is fieldwork, and missionaries are simply in the field, carefully observing and recording much, much longer than almost any anthropologist can expect it to be. A dirty secret of anthropologists is that they sometimes steal much of their results from the work of missionaries, often lean on them heavily while in the field, and then go around disparaging them ever after. Therefore, anthropologists need to say that the faith commitments of missionaries disqualify them from doing truly scholarly work in order to open up a space for themselves as the professionals. This hostility is illustrated in the case of the missionary position. Numerous anthropologists have mentioned in their writings that missionaries once insisted on one sexual position as the only appropriate one, condemning other practices in the cultures where they worked as sinful. In the minds of these anthropologists, the missionary position is a classic example of the prudish, joyless, rule-obsessed, life-denying influence of missionaries. The notion of a sexual position dictated by missionaries has become such a common fact that it shows up in dictionaries, in works of reference, in magazines and newspapers, seemingly everywhere. Nevertheless, Robert J. Priest, in a 2001 issue of Current Anthropology, has demonstrated incontrovertibly that it is an urban legend. At no time and in no place did any missionary ever teach any such thing. It turns out that the notion of a missionary position was coined by the famous social scientist Alfred Kinsey in his Sexual Behavior in the Human Male, 1948. Kinsey claimed to have learned of this from the anthropologist Malinowski. Kinsey had misremembered this, however, and in a way that reveals hostility to missionaries. What Malinowski actually wrote was an account of seeing an engaged couple. These were actually Trobian Islanders who had converted to Christianity, so young converts, and they were also engaged, and they were kind of leaning against one another, hugging, and they were holding hands. So the other people called this behaving in missionary fashion, one of the novel immoralities introduced by missionaries. In other words, the missionary position actually represents the influence of missionaries decreasing prudishness and restrictions in an affirmation of joy, life, love, and sexuality. Such an affirming story is not retold, however, but rather replaced with a fictitious story that puts the missionaries in an unfavorable light, and this is done, I am positing, because of a conflict is needed in order to help the anthropologists establish themselves as the only professionals when it comes to gaining knowledge about people, groups across the globe. All right, I will try to re-engage your interest by seeing if I can do off the cuff the bit that I'm working on missionaries right now. So one example of this is what to think about fieldwork. I've been tracking this across the history of anthropology in Britain. And in the early part of this 20th century, the most famous anthropologist was Sir James Fraser, who wrote The Golden Bough. And Fraser says that fieldwork disqualifies somebody from being a professional anthropologist. Because what a professional anthropologist does is they sit at the center of empire in London with great libraries, and they do comparative work among all the data of different people around the world. So a missionary is in the field and doesn't have the perspective, therefore, to do comparative work in a great library, and therefore all they can do is send in their notes to Sir James Fraser, who will then tell them what they mean. And he's the anthropologist, and he does great work. He never left Europe. You know, so he's an anthropologist of the armchair old school, now totally discredited in that regard. But fieldwork meant that you weren't doing real anthropology. Well, anthropologists soon decide that fieldwork is actually essential to doing real anthropology. The next phase was a famous anthropologist called Rivers. And Rivers decided that he had a magic method of doing anthropological research that would create all kinds of results. And he explicitly says, I don't know if I should do the quotes or not, but I'll summarize again, that people who have been in the field for decades and know the people really well and the languages really well, they won't know what's really going on unless you do his genealogical method where you ask certain questions about kinship. But him, and he admits this quite freely, just showing up for a few days and not knowing the language, asking questions through an interpreter, finds out more about the culture than people who've lived and worked with them for decades. So that was phase two. Missionaries don't have the magic method. So they're not real anthropologists. Real anthropologists do the genealogical method. Even though they don't know the language, they always show up on visit. This is the survey phase. We're from armchair to survey. Well, once again, after a while, that was realized that that was not effective. And best practice became that you're in the field in one place for at least 18 months to do real anthropological work. And it's all about a specific ethnography, one culture that you know well, which is what missionaries have been doing all the way along. My favorite quote researching this paper, then, you know, how do you distinguish that missionaries are not real anthropologists once you've come to that realization? So this is from the president of the Oxford Anthropological Society, I think in the 1940s, once the field work has been established for anthropologists. And he says, the problem with missionaries is that they're in the field too long, which may lead, as in the case of some missionaries, to stubborn and preconceived opinions. So you have to be there for 18 months and then leave. and then you can kind of clear your mind and you think new thoughts, and that's real anthropology. So you can see it's completely contradictory throughout the history, but the one thing that's constant is whatever missionaries are doing, that is not real anthropology. All right. To reframe my argument in another way, I am suspicious of the assumption that it was something intrinsic to the nature of modern discoveries that caused the perception that faith and learning were at odds. I am suspicious specifically of the assumption that the advance of scientific knowledge in the last 150 to 200 years has created an unprecedented problem for the reconciliation of faith and learning. The story of the 19th century is actually one in which Orthodox Christian ministers, theologians, churches, and denominations accepted dramatic scientific developments with remarkable little fuss. Christians quickly accepted the new findings of geology, for example, and an earth that is millions of years old was the standard view among clergymen even well before Charles Darwin's On the Origin of the Species, 1859. Likewise, the introduction of Darwinism into Victorian thought is not a story of denominations making official pronouncements against it or clergymen lining up to attack it, but rather of widespread acceptance and even championing of it by ministers and theologians. In fact, I'm going to do another bit on that, but I'll improvise one as well. Right before Darwin, there were a whole group of secular scientists, the ones that were most self-consciously secular, who said that the true science of human species was polygenesis, that essentially Africans were a different species of being from Europeans. And the only reason why people believed that that there was one human race, one human nature, was because of Christian myth. And so Christians were old-fashioned obscurantist people who believed in one human race until Darwin came along and demonstrated his own reason why there was one human race, and then suddenly, okay, Christians weren't obscurantists for believing that. That turns out to be fine. All right. The warfare model is often advanced by focusing on Bishop Wilberforce opposing Darwinism in a debate with T.H. Huxley. This incident is usually deployed to show that the church refuses to accept scientific findings and is rather obscurantist. In fact, this debate took place at the leading scientific society in England at that time, the British Association for the Advancement of Science, meeting at Oxford University. Moreover, it took place at its first meeting after the publication of Darwin's On the Origin of the Species, which was only 7 months after the book came out. Wilberforce was chosen to represent the opposite side, not because he was a bishop or a clergyman or a Christian, but because he was known for his Oxford Union days, from his Oxford Union days, to be a brilliant debater. So they just picked up who could front the other side in this debate. Moreover, Wilberforce did not advance religious objections to Darwinism, but rather scientific ones. In short, it is ridiculous to label someone as obscurantist or hostile to the advance of science for taking the opposing view in the very first debate of a new and startling scientific theory that had just been published months earlier. Indeed, the main champion of Darwinism in America was himself a devout evangelical Christian, Asa Gray, professor of botany at Harvard University. Or to take another example, a major popularizer of evolution for evangelicals was the 19th century evangelist Henry Drummond, a colleague of the great Chicago revivalist D.L. Moody. Drummond wrote best-selling religious books in which he incorporated his assumption that Darwinism was sound science into evangelical theology. These names are only illustrative. It would take a long, long time to list all the prominent Orthodox Christian ministers, theologians, and thinkers who accepted Darwinism promptly as good science that did not conflict with Christian teaching. Of course, one of the most famous ways that the notion of a warfare between faith and science has been implanted in people's minds is through evoking the case of Galileo. So I'd like to take a few moments here to tell you how I think about the Galileo case as a church historian. It is certainly true that Galileo's ideas about the nature of the solar system were investigated and condemned by the Inquisition. This historical detail does not teach us that Christianity is typically opposed to scientific advances, however. What it really tells us is that the medieval Inquisition was a power-hungry, control-freak, oppressive institution. It was terribly afraid of anything it did not understand or could not control, and was quick to use force to suppress it. This is a classic example of a corrupt institution, an abuse of power, and of unchristian things being done in the name of Christ. It has huge lessons to teach us about the question of Christianity and power. but it does not have much to teach us about Christianity and science. In fact, far more saints than scientists were persecuted by the Inquisition. Joan of Arc, for example, was condemned as a heretic and burnt at the stake. Whoops. Galileo was only confined to house arrest. Joan of Arc was burnt at the stake by the Inquisition. Since her death, Joan of Arc has been formally canonized by the Roman Catholic Church and is now one of the most popular and beloved of saints. So, you know, the lesson of that is not that the church hates saints, okay? If the Inquisition was a power-hungry, control-freak institution that didn't like anything that looked like it was outside of its control or the norm. There are many lessons to learn from this dark chapter of church history, but the idea that the Christian faith and modern science are inherently in conflict is not one of them. The word fundamentalist came from a series of pamphlets published in the early 1910s entitled The Fundamentals, A Testament to the Truth. Remarkably, in the light of subsequent history, several of the contributors to this series that literally served to launch the fundamentalist movement were ministers and theologians who believed in evolution. The Princeton theologian B.B. Warfield, who is famous for championing biblical inerrancy, was one of them. Another was James Orr, a professor of apologetics in Scotland, who wrote the very first tract in the Fundamentals. Another was George Frederick Wright, an American biblical archaeologist. Nevertheless, later in the series came a couple anti-evolution tracts, most notably one by an obscure author entitled Decadence of Darwinism. This was a sign of where the nascent fundamentalist movement was heading. After a full biblical generation of certain polemical scientists promoting the notion that there was a war between faith and learning, conservative Christians came to believe it. At this crucial moment, the war metaphor would be adopted by the other side. Fundamentalists now published volumes with titles such as The Great Conflict, The Battle of Faith, and War on Modernism. So in other words, they've appropriated the warfare imagery and model. The result has been a widespread suspicion of mainstream scholars by conservative Christians. The possibility of a vast godless conspiracy by academics or scientists is a real one in many fundamentalist or conservative evangelical minds. The resulting anti-intellectualism, lamented and explored in Mark Knowles' classic study, The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind, has taken a great toll. In other words, although certain strident secularist scientists in the second half of the 19th century constructed the notion of a war between faith and learning, conservative Christians deserve their share of the blame for having adopted and perpetuated this model in the 20th century and beyond. The notion of a war between faith and science has been so successful that now some conservative Christians can cavalierly dismiss the evidence for global warming as a result of human behavior, not on the basis of countervailing scientific evidence, but on the very grounds that it comes from scientists who we are opposed to and should not trust. Huxley, I suspect, has got more than he bargained for. Well, to quote John Lennon, war is over if you want it. If the notion that it is getting harder, if not becoming impossible, to reconcile an Orthodox Christian faith with the latest findings by scholars is actually fictitious, then where do we go from here? After the conflict between faith and learning comes the integration of faith and learning. This is what came before the warfare imagery as well. In other words, it has always been the task of learned thinking Christians to take seriously both orthodoxy and the latest learning and to find a way to think about both of them in a coherent, faithful, non-compartmentalized way. Integration does not mean that historic Christian commitments are abandoned or contorted in the face of every wind of intellectual fashion. Neither does it mean that new scholarly findings leave our old ways of speaking about the faith completely untouched. Rather, it means the difficult intellectual work is done of making the call on what is and is not a part of the faith which is once delivered unto the saints. This has been done in every generation. Already in the second century, Justin Martyr was working on the integration of the Christian faith with classical learning, including the philosophy of Socrates and Plato. In the Middle Ages, Thomas Aquinas pursued the integration of faith with the intellectual culture of a revised Aristotelianism. One can see in the Reformation, both in the Catholic form as articulated by Erasmus and in the Protestant form as articulated by Calvin, a theological appropriation of the new climate of humanism. These integrations involve both changing the way Christians think and speak about theological issues and a willingness to hold to orthodoxy even when current intellectual fashions assail it. So Yeah, I teach Justin Martyr pretty much every year, and I always have students, and maybe rightly so. This is part of the conversation that's going on. We always go on, which makes it lively and interesting. Who think that Justin Martyr just went too far in trying to use Platonic concepts to make a bridge to Christianity. So maybe he got the integration wrong because he gave away too much to his context. And so I say, well, that's possible. All of us have to find a way to draw a line. But I point out, you know, that when he was in grade school and wrote his name on forms, he didn't put his last name Martyr. So obviously, he was not somebody who was accommodating to the culture around him. He was somebody who was so repugnant to the culture around him that they killed him. So there are clear limits on how far the integration went for him to make his ideas compatible with his world. Thomas Aquinas accepted many beliefs of Aristotelian thought, but rejected his teaching on the eternity of matter because he discerned that it was incompatible with the Orthodox Christian doctrine of creation ex nihilo. This is what is meant by integration. Therefore, as I have used Darwinism as a case study for part of this article, I would like to point out what I mean by integration is not that Christians should accept evolution uncritically in toto. In my own theological reflection on this subject, I would insist that any potential integration with Darwinism preserve the following elements. God is creator, human beings as uniquely made in the image of God, yet fallen and sinful, and the Bible as a unique, truthful, and trustworthy communication of the inspired Word of God written. I should also clarify that, of course, there were also Christian ministers in the 19th century who were public and vocal opponents of Darwinism. The point is that this should not be viewed as part of a war in which the church opposes science or learning, but rather as an example of the kind of in-house conversations that Christians have always had. No different in kind from the church father Tertullian's rejection of the significant drawing upon Platonic thought that was done by fellow believers, following the pattern set by Justin Martyr, or the way that 13th century Franciscans were more resistant to the appropriation of Aristotelian thought than the Dominicans were. All right, in the original published paper, I had a kind of attempt at an eloquent ending, which I just cut off. So I've got one more paragraph, but this talk will then just kind of, rather than clue, just kind of grind to a halt suddenly, okay? So be prepared for an anticlimax. Integration is not easy. And it is all the harder in a time when a climate of suspicion has been created by the now entrenched warfare model. I am well aware that as long as there are secularist thinkers in disciplines or Christians in other faith communities for whom the war is not over, then the legacy will continue to impinge on us in negative ways that we cannot control. I'm gonna underline that one sentence as well. I've talked to a lot of evangelical Christians doing graduate work at secular institutions in natural sciences. Gave a talk to some of them at the University of Chicago, for example, and they were much more worried about, they were less worried about their professors and their intellectual climate at the university being anti-Christian than they were worried about their home churches being anti-science. That's where it's currently how it looks on the front line to some of them. Nevertheless, there is much that we can do to further integration for ourselves and our communities. For integration to be successful, it involves both a commitment to and a sympathetic and learned understanding of both the content of the Christian faith and the scholarly discipline under consideration. In other words, pastors who know the Bible and theology well but are ignorant of the actual contours of a secular body of knowledge cannot do integration. Likewise, scholars who know their discipline well, but who only have a hazy understanding of the contours of the scriptures and classic Christian orthodoxy cannot do integration effectively either, even if they happen to be personally devout Christians. In conclusion, the way forward must be a sympathetic collaboration between groups of people of goodwill from both of these areas of expertise, a collaboration that results in everyone becoming progressively more literate in both areas. This will include not only doing reading outside of our own disciplines, but also, I think, making friendships outside of our own areas and collaborations in that. And there into the text. Do I get down or sit?
Now we've got plenty of time for questions. I can field them, or if you'd like to field your own questions, then you're fine.
I just do whatever you tell me, Robert.
You can field them, and then when it's time to sort of save you from.
If some crank starts going on and on, could you be the one that intervenes and not me?
I will do that.
All right.
Yes.
There's another kind of war going on that has to do with science and faith. That's the war between the design scientists and the, which we call theistic scientists. And there seems to be a difficulty, these things that I've heard, difficulty in either side. I say accepting the other side as being legitimate voices in the conflict. What is your take on that?
Yeah. My take on that is that.
Could you repeat the question for the recorder?
Okay. The question was about another war between kind of an intelligent design side and more theistic evolution side, which seems awful strong and bitter and high stakes, and why is that war the way it is? My impression is that both sides think that, you know, it's the iceberg, that most of it you can't see, that accepting it is going to connect them to something big that they don't want to be connected to, that will discredit them. So there's not a distinction between who is the person in front of me and what are they arguing for, but what would other people say that I have kind of joined if in some way I'm connected with them? I think that happens on both sides. I'll give a kind of example in my own field. I actually wrote a bit about this in Inside Higher Ed in a piece called No Christianity, Please, We're Academics. I put in a proposal to do this kind of series that Yale University Press has of kind of classic texts, and I put in a proposal to do one on T.S. Eliot's book, Essay on Christian Culture. And it was fascinating. What do they know about me? You know, I teach at Wheaton College. They know I'm a historian with historical credentials, and that I want to do a book on T.S. Eliot. But the readers' reports from the board, so I got probably maybe 10 reports back from the board that run this. They thought they knew about me that I was Republican, that I was anti-feminist. They had this whole list of things that they had seen underneath the water somehow, which is not actually there, it turns out. But so they didn't want Yale University Press to be anything to do with this book, even though they admitted that it was a good proposal and I was a good scholar and credentials were all right, the idea was a worthy one, but that would connect us to something that we find repugnant. And so I think that is why that issue is a motive, is because of those assumptions on both sides.
In some areas of the country, the debate continues about teaching creationism in public schools alongside of evolutionism. And who's causing that conflict? Is that the Christians that are pushing that, or is that the non-Christians? Or can you comment about what your advice for that situation would be?
Wow. I hadn't thought of it that way. That's a great question. The question was on who's generating the conflict on teaching creationism in schools. I would say two things about that. Again, I get to feel like I'm an expert because I'm up here and you're not. But, you know, I'm just telling you, things all out by hand. One is there are committed people on both. It's one of those kind of entrenched issues where this is a hot-button issue for identity, like abortion, and you could name lots of other things like that. And so there are committed groups on both sides that want to agitate on that issue as a way of expressing their identity and how they see a conflict in America. So that would be part one. So you have, I would suspect people on both sides of that fight who are vigilant and actually looking for ways to express their strong views by finding a cause célèbre. Together with that, it's a kind of lazy set piece way of framing things in the media now. And the media are bone lazy, let me tell you. they will never come up with a new narrative on anything if they can help it. They will just milk the old one for as long as their career goes on. So certain kind of things. I remember. Okay, I'll give an example on that. When I first came back to the faculty here, so maybe around 2003, they had a leading medical researcher, I believe, somebody like that, come and talk about AIDS in a talk in Edmund Chapel. It was a high-profile speaker. I can't remember who it was, but it was a big crowd. And he said, oh, you know, there was a time when you couldn't even mention condoms in Edmund Chapel. So we all kind of laughed at ourselves. You know, yeah, that's true. So, fine. That was all good. But the next day, the Chicago Tribune reported the event, and they said, the first time condoms were mentioned, the audience tittered. You know, he told a joke and we laughed at it, but it was as if we couldn't cope with the word condom being said. You know, so it was like, you know, it was like you were there the same event that I was, but this is a narrative that you know, and you're going to frame this journalist story in this narrative no matter what happens. And the narrative of the culture war is definitely one that journalists they'll put the story in that box whether it fits or not.
I guess within the last 2 weeks, Ian Barber died, the philosopher of science. Are you familiar with his?
I think I read an obituary, but yeah, I'm not going to be able to.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, first I was going to say that the first two lines were Ian Barber, who had analyzed the divide between science and faith, went to church.
Yeah.
But I was just going to ask, and maybe Robert could talk a little bit about what was. Was his approach helpful
I definitely can't answer that. You want to jump up and take a shot?
What should I say about? Well, probably the thing that he's most known for is giving for some people very effective way of sort of categorizing how it is you can think of science and faith as relating to one another. Are they in conflict was one of his models, and that's exactly what Tim has been talking about, cooperation, are they complementary, and so forth. And I think a lot of people have found that useful, at least on the Christian side, and those non-Christians who are sort of interested in talking about, say, Stephen Jay Gould, for example, are interested in talking about these other things, although Gould would ultimately say, no, they have to be in two separate categories.
But it's different from the warfare model. He rejected the warfare model, but he came up with his own model.
Right,
yeah.
Right. So, and he was always trying to advocate that there ultimately isn't a warfare. There is a way of finding some kind of correspondence between them. But there are some options that religious believers can take.
Yes?
As an anthropologist, I'd like to offer a different perspective on the conflict that you talked about. And, certainly from the anthropology side, not there wasn't animosity on the side of the missionaries, there was, but that's not what we're talking about tonight. It's a sociology of knowledge kind of book. For much of the 20th century, if you were out doing fieldwork in some remote part of the world, especially for an American university, you had to come back with information about a belief or a behavior that nobody had ever heard of before.
Yes, yes.
That would guarantee you your doctrine. And so, throughout much of the 20th century, we wanted to find out what were the limits of human cultural and behavioral variation. And the only way to do it is to go to the outer limits.
Yes.
If a missionary was there,
yes,
you almost by definition were not at the outer limits. And so there was an effort to go to places where missionaries were not to be found, not to any of those places. Or if missionaries were found, where they were not particularly active or successful by missionaries. Mm. And so then the antipathy there, I think, was
grounded
primarily in what people needed to be able to do.
Very, very helpful comment on the fact that anthropologists had a practical problem that missionaries got to the field first, and that this kind of spoiled their samples, another way that I would put it, that there was always a concern, do people do this and believe this because they were influenced by missionaries, if they were there first, or is this, you know, a pure kind of primitive context in the way it was said in the mid-20th century. There was a whole other literature that talks about how surprisingly similar anthropologists and missionaries are. There's an article called subtitled was Brothers Under the Skin, which is a famous trying to show these similarities. And one of the ones that I would add is they're both always dreaming of unreached people groups. You know, missionaries and anthropologists both had the same dream, which is to find some isolated tribe that nobody else has had contact with, and they're the first ones to make contact. One of the ones I read this week, Lucy Marr, and she was trying to explain the hostility. She was trained under Malinowski in the late 1920s and early 1930s. And she said, "Well, we had a reason to hate missionaries because they were bringing unwanted change to traditional people." And then she spent her whole career in a faculty position called colonial administration. You know, so it's like this kind of strange thing where you get a very late critique of missionaries as doing cultural imperialism, and literally probably a decade in between, and before that you had anthropologists marketing themselves as people who were the best ones to train colonial officers. That is also another irony of that world. Thank you. Yes?
Do you see any hope in popular culture for resolving at least what's perceived to be a conflict? And other than the students at like a leading college where you're getting the natural sciences, you're getting the theology, and you actually have the time and you're being pushed to kind of create the synthesis that we can resolve and reconcile the two parts. In the real world, people don't know theology, they don't know science, and so they have nothing to synthesize from it. They're lazy. And sometimes it's just easier to say, rather than go through all of this to try to get to some synthesis, it's just easier to say, well, I have a fundamental understanding of Scripture, science conflicts with that, I don't have to go to science, I can be antagonistic toward it, I can be anti-intellectual, and I can be in my little comfort zone here and pretty much live my life.
Yeah, so the question was, how optimistic can we be about ordinary Christians who don't have time to look into these things and even kind of the inclination in some ways to overcome this problem? I guess where I hope would happen, so this is just kind of, you know, kind of relocating the wistfulness, is a higher level of trustfulness among Christians. So I think what exacerbates the problem is the kind of conspiracy theory mentality. So I would long for a culture that says, here is a godly young woman in our congregation who is doing advanced research in this field. We trust her. We believe in her faith. We believe in her spiritual formation. It happened in our own context. And now she's learning something that we don't have time to learn. But we're going to have time enough to listen to her and say, do you see these things in conflict or not? Can you help us get farther with it? So I think that the problem is so entrenched because we're not only not having time to learn or not being willing to learn, but we're very quick to dismiss the people that have learned as unfaithful or biased or part of some vast conspiracy. And so, at that point, what counts for evidence? How does the discussion go forward when there's that level of skewed about how you're going to even receive information? So, we do that in our lives. We influence people. We meet people. We talk to them. We try to convince them. And again, Wheaton is not the only place, but it is a place where that happens. And there are places around the country where there are either Christian institutions or Christian professors or secular institutions that do make an impact on their students, and then that goes on and makes an impact on other people. And sometimes they write books that make an impact as well. So, but it is a big problem. Yes?
How well defined is the conflict between science and faith in the sense of what groups do we currently consider to be representative of science and faith? Because it seems like that has changed. In the past, you know, the science, as you pointed out, might not have been atheists doing science. It would have still been Christians doing science and Christians in faith, but that could have been the institutional church, it could have been the average Christian. Has that, has like the groups representing science and faith changed in any kind of like descriptive way? And kind of, where is that now? What are the two main groups that represent science and faith today?
That's a great question. The question was, who speaks for science? Who speaks for faith? How are those big categories being populated? I think that points out how rhetorically kind of diffuse this whole conversation is. So the Christian part is the one that I want to focus on because I'm a church historian. So you have, you know, Deborah Bloom proving her point by saying the Scottish Calvinist Church, which is not a name of a church, creates a statement, which she has a quote from a non-existent church. You know, there's a non-existent statement, non-existent church, and yet she has quotes on what they exactly said. And then with my little, you know, thing with blog thing with Alan Jacobs, you know, and it gets down to the evidence is this person said that they overheard these two Christians talking and they said this. I really got to kind of pause on that because just imagine if atheists were accountable for every kind of kooky atheist who ever blogged anything or tweeted anything as, oh, you know, I know that atheists want to burn down synagogues because I overheard once, you know, these two 14-year-old atheists kind of, so that becomes, that leaps from hearsay evidence to the defining pronouncement of the church, you know, it's amazing. So to ask your question more specifically, in the past, in the 19th century, which I study, it was the Catholic Church was usually the kind of the benchmark standard. But the Catholic Church has actually been very kind of casual about science issues for a good 50 years now. And so there isn't a conflict there. If you want somebody who's really comfortable with modern thought, you know, talk to a Jesuit. So then it's kind of shifted to fundamentalist. But fundamentalist is kind of a depopulated category as well. Who are the fundamentalists? And everybody will tell you Bob Jones, university. And I said, well, besides them. And that's it, it turns out. Pretty much. You know, I looked into that a bit very carefully. You know, places like Liberty, Cedarville, whoever you think of as kind of holding to young earth, those kind of things, they do not accept the label fundamentalist for themselves. So again, fundamentalist becomes almost this rhetorical thing as well. It's just somebody that we know is a bad guy, but who speaks for fundamentalism? Is there, you know, there is no major, you know, fundamentalist leader who's a voice for a big movement anymore. That's a kind of cultural moment that's not here anymore. I think science is easier in the sense that you have scientific organizations and you have people with doctorates in science and all those kind of things. But you have people who I think can reasonably be said to be spokespersons for science, but that gets fuzzy in a couple ways as well. One, because there, like you pointed out, there's lots of people who are Christians who are scientists, so you can't put scientists versus Christians or the church because people are in both categories. And then you have people like Richard Dawkins, who is a real scientist, but he's often making pronouncements that do not arise in any way out of his scientific expertise. And so he's a scientist, but he's not doing science right now. He's doing kind of public advocacy. And so, is he speaking for science? Is there, you know, can you say scientists believe this, or a scientist happens to believe this, even though it doesn't really relate to his training? You know, so that would be another kind of complication of the same question. When does this end, Robert? Does this go on and on? Okay.
Now, officially, we would end at 8:30, but we might end if you were out of questions soon.
If you just kind of look more and more bored and tired, Robert, look at the hand, and we'll all go. But if you have more questions, that's fine. Yes?
Do Are you aware of a seminary or a preacher in the last 10 years that teaches that the sixth trump includes a description of the evil one claiming to be Christ being on earth before the seventh events when Christ will arrive?
I cannot think of a major Christian leader who is talking about eschatology at all. So again, that there was, when I was growing up, there was enormous detail on eschatology, which this kind of question reflects. And we've had one eccentric radio personality claim that he knew the exact date Christ was coming, and that's the only thing I think of in the last 10 years that could in any way correlate between a major Christian leader making any kind of pronouncement on eschatology. I can only say that is a kind of observation that's hugely different from my childhood, where eschatology was a major interest of all kinds of Christian leaders, and you had best-selling books and those kind of things. But we still have best-selling books, but they're the purpose-driven life and those kind of things. They're not the late great panel on earth, you know. So,
a couple of the more modern scientists who have been more accommodationist in their approach, like Stephen Jay Gould, E.O. Wilson. And yet, when I look at them, I realize non-overlapping magisteria, that trivializes faith to me. Sociobiology, we're explaining all of human behavior on reductionistic terms, and including religion as being one of those things. So even these two gentlemen who have been willing to at least make room for this debate, interestingly seem to underhand, or, well, I don't know if it's underhanded or not, but
Yeah. So the question is, some of the secular scientists who've gotten rid of the Werfel model nevertheless seem to have done it in a little kind of too neat, sweeping way that kind of trivializes faith. I think that's right. That's my own response to that is the kind of integration is hard section of my paper. It's not easy to think about every new theory in lots of disciplines and potential discoveries and actual discoveries and what that does and does not entail for thinking about the faith in a faithful way. And that's why I liked, again, I know those are kind of inside baseball kind of illustrations for a trip to Sorin, but I liked the illustrations of, you know, the debate between Franciscans and Dominicans about Aristotelian thought in the 13th century. That's kind of how it really is. What if that's more accurate picture of what it's really like? That you have people who are inside house who both are saying something's going on here, and yet some are more comfortable with accommodating and others less comfortable. They're doing it in different ways, different degrees. I think that's how every generation of Christians lives. I also think it's very important, particularly at Wheaton College, where students hear the word integration too often and roll their eyes at it, that we admit that lots of things we're not the hero who can fix on the day. So I think it's very important that we say a lot more than we do say. This discipline seems to be coming up with this result that looks like all we can tell is a true result. That makes me uncomfortable as a Christian because it seems to conflict in some ways with this claim of Scripture or this historic Christian doctrine. And again, I'm not the hero who could put those two things together on the day. But what I'm not going to do is either fudge my faith to make the dissidents go away and get credibility with a secular world of thought, or ignore or deny this evidence because it'll make me feel more comfortable as a Christian. I'm going to choose to name and live with that dissidence. And that, frankly, for some issues, sometimes might last a whole generation or more. And maybe a judge will arise in Israel who actually will come up with a really sweet theory, and we'll just all say, go read John Walton's book, it's fine now, never mind. Or maybe not, you know. But, you know, that was happened. But the expectation that we should all, because we care about this issue and believe it's a real issue, should all have a kind of neat answer, I think that's more dangerous and more suspicious and less intellectually honest. And so I want to underline the hard part of the integration is hard sentence. Yes?
In terms of resolving this issue, how do you see that schools like Wheaton College and other schools which tend to spawn some of the evangelical leaders of the future fail? And how would you suggest that we improve our approach to resolving this issue?
Yeah. How does Wheaton College fail at this issue, and how could we improve? So hard to discern. And part of why that's hard to discern is because people come to Wheaton from very different places and experience it in very different ways. If we do fail with some people, the one that comes to mind that I worry about is people becoming fearful of knowledge, on the one hand. So a kind of Christian conservatism that says, I don't want to learn too much about that because it might undermine my faith. And on the other, a desire to fit in with the wider culture that's so driving that we are willing to minimize or forfeit our faith. And both of those things go on here. They're opposite things, but they both go on here. We can be fearful of the wider culture. We can't have a let's-not-think-about-it approach to certain issues because it's safer. But we also love the sweet smell of success. And deep in Wheaton's bones, there's a love of success. And on a bad day, we're willing to trade faith for success for some people. You know, and there's a big kind of, they play for the Boston Symphony Orchestra and they're a Wheaton grad. Too bad they're no longer a Christian, but still they pay for the Boston. You know, that sense of, well, at least you succeeded is kind of, strong here. And I feel that. In my own career, all the time, I'm trying to write really good, thoughtful Christian integrated books and publish them with Oxford University Press. But it could easily kind of degenerate into just, well, at least I published it with Oxford University Press, kind of as that's enough. So, be kind.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tim. So be sure and take your name tags, if you have one, and put them back on the table out here. You basically are dismissed, except if you're in my senior seminar. We now have to talk about Tim's lecture. Tim will perhaps hang around a little bit if people want to come up and ask him anything else, or if nobody wants
money back or not.
We do want the... There is a money box here somewhere.
Right here.
Okay. Somebody moderately trustworthy has it. So please feel free to come up and talk with Tim if you'd like, or if nobody entertains you, you can come talk to my senior seminar. But that's
okay.
not to put you on the spot. But all right, thanks for coming out this evening, and stay warm on your way home.
Yeah.